I've been teaching the history of religions, or what more people call world religions, for nearly 25 years now. And as I have opportunity, I learn about one more major sector of human religious experience and practice. And as I add those together, all the major religions of the world, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity in the Abrahamic religions, Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism, in the Indian complex, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, Shinto, tribal religions of Africa, tribal religions of Australia, tribal religions of Native Americans. As I add all that together, of course, I have to be asking all kinds of big questions as I go along. Not only do I notice a lot of things that feel similar to me, things that ring bells with my own spirituality, but I meet a lot of things that don't ring bells at first. But after I probe them and understand them better, it's not so far away after all from some of the things that I know and understand myself. But as you do all that, the question keeps emerging, what about the relationship of people of other religions to the one we call God? The one God. Christians claim there is just one God, and so they'll have to get rid of the question, is their God the same as our God? That question, which is one of the early questions that people ask when we start talking about other religions, is their God the same as our God? Well, if one has by faith said there is one God, then I guess the answer has to be yes, it's the same God. But clearly they are responding to that God in some different ways. So there's a very, very big question there. And of course the church has always wondered, does God in any way hold people of other religions in the embrace of his eternal love? If they do not know or do not understand and are not able to accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, can he still hold them somehow in his love eternally? Must we make a judgment that says, no, they are damned, and this little segment of the world's population ends up embraced eternally in God's love? Only this little sector of the human population, if you think of through time and space, that little group that has been called the people of Christ. Is that? And if it is possible that God might somehow, in ways not known to us, embrace all those people, or many of those people, by criterion of his own, not ours, does it matter if I bear witness to? Does it matter how I respond to God at all? All such questions just kind of keep stirring around as I go about my business, trying to understand the other religion by getting inside the skin and the psyche of other people, of other cultures, and of other religions, and trying to see the whole matter through their eyes as much as I can. Those questions haunt me in the background. Now, I always feel as though we aren't ready to deal with that question very much, although I shouldn't be too picky about that, unless we have at least begun to make attempts to understand the other religions from within. For what can we say about them if we know nothing about them? We cannot say anything with respect, probably, about them unless we do know them somewhat from within, or as though from within. Can we have enough imagination to imagine ourselves into their situation? That's the big effort that I think it takes. Understanding other people is an act of the imagination, because my experiences are not the same as yours, and the way I have processed my experiences through life are not the way you have processed even similar external stimuli become meaning different, have a different meaning to you. So the only way I could learn to understand you or my wife or my children or anybody else is by a compassionate effort of the imagination to try to know how it might feel to you. You know, we have to do that all the time. If we say we understand one another, or we're getting to understand one another in our friendships and our families, that means we are projecting ourselves into how it might feel to the other one, because it isn't the same to me. Now, take that job of projecting oneself into the other person's place. Take that job to the level of cross-cultural studies. Take that job to studies of other religions. You've got a big job. But I maintain that we can make some good headways in that direction. We can never feel it and see it exactly as they see it and feel it. But we can approach that. And so we can come to a sympathetic and maybe even appreciative understanding of other people's religions. Now that's sort of some background, because there are many of you that are new faces, and we haven't been with me, at least in the last couple of days, on some of these other religions. But now we'll check the question about the encounter, Christians encountering other people of other religions. Let's just do a quick history of that period, of the nature of this encounter with other religions. In the beginning of the Christian movement, it was, I guess, what many people would call a cult, Christianity was. That is, it was a minority group in somewhat of a protest against its majority environment. It was a little group gathered around a charismatic leader and following from there. Which brings up the question, of course, of how they were treated then. And maybe we can make a real big jump and remind ourselves how such groups, new religions, quote unquote, are treated in this country now. They're outside the mainstream. They dress different. They act different. They sell books in the airports and annoy us, and things like that. And the United States has a beautiful record of persecuting such groups, I think. Literally persecuting them, finding any excuse possible to make it difficult for them to function. And the pressure for that seems to come especially from Christian people who are scared to death of those things, afraid those things might influence them or might influence their young ones, and so they'd like to use any legal means, any means necessary, to get them out of the picture. If we go back far enough into American history, we know that the people who came over to this country for religious freedom came over for their own religious freedom, not for anybody else's, and when the next group came over that was not of their persuasion, they were persecuted. So the Puritans and people of that sort persecuted the next groups that came over because it wasn't supposed to be for them. So we don't have a very clean record of living up to the whole matter of freedom of religion. Nowadays, of course, then, I suggest that we do persecute these religious groups, and then we go on about our business of accusing them of brainwashing people instead of converting them. We don't call it conversion, we call it brainwashing. And then we feel justified in going about the business of kidnapping and deprogramming. And so that whole issue, which of course is extraordinarily complex and there are no simple black and white answers to it. But Christianity began as such an offbeat, off to the side, out of the mainstream religion with claims that were ridiculous when judged by the mainstream, and it was dangerous. It was dangerous to the faith of the godly people of Israel. That's why Saul was headed to Damascus. Not because he was a mean man, but because he was a loving man who wanted to protect the poor people, the poor innocent peasants of Judaism, from getting caught up with this big Christian lie. That's why he went there. So he was trying to do something nice for the people of Judaism, to protect them like we would like to protect. Well, as time went on, we see that Christianity at best begins to be judged as a sect within Judaism. That is, the Gentile world looked at Judaism and Christianity and said, well, this is a little offshoot. This is a little sect within, and they've had lots of sects before of people making great claims and to be prophets and to be messiahs and things like that. Here's another one. We won't judge it. It's just another one of those. So it is, at its beginning, a sect of Judaism which gradually makes more and more clean a separation from Judaism, and the hostility between the parent faith and the new faith begins to grow more and more tense along the way there. Nevertheless, in the early centuries of Christianity, the Christian people could not avoid one thing, and that is being engaged with, being in dialogue with representatives of the other religions. Their own former teachers, their own parents were Jews, and they, with their belief in Jesus as the Christ, were in conversation, in debate about that, about what this could mean and how they could be related to each other. And the early Christian teachers studied the Gnostic teachers and the other mystery religions of the time in the Hellenistic world, in the Turkey and Greece and that whole region of the northern Mediterranean. And they studied the philosophers of that time, and they studied all those who made pronouncements about religions, and they felt as though they had to understand that. With these Christian fathers, who they were scholars and teachers of the faith. We call them the early church fathers. And they studied these other things to try to understand them and how they might fit into the whole overall plan of God. So you have someone like Justin Martyr, who says, after he looks at all of that, that all of these things are in some way a preparation for the good news of Jesus the Christ. So, what he was saying is that all the other religions of the world at that time were actually legitimate in some sense as a preparation for the coming of the climax. Jesus, the one who was the fulfillment of it all. Well, that's an interesting thing for him to say. He was not saying that all of it is to be damned, all of it was off base, or maybe even to say all of it was off base except the true form of Judaism or something in there. He wasn't even saying that. He was saying it was all in some sense preparing the way. It's an interesting engagement with, interesting encounter with the non-Christian religions of his time. And Clement of Alexandria talked in a way that was similar to that. But we can bypass that fairly soon, because it wasn't very long, depending on how you count centuries, but it wasn't very long before Constantine comes along in the early 4th century. About 325, we'll just use that as the rough date for that. And we get a new story. First, he legitimizes Christianity in the empire, allows it to become a legitimate religion so it couldn't be persecuted anymore. Then he declares that it becomes the official religion of the empire, and then declares that all other religions are to be done away with, to be stamped out. All right, little by little then, the whole table has turned as we get the transformation of the empire into a quote-unquote Christian empire.
Ed, mm-hmm. You mentioned before in the early Christian fathers having a world view of other different religions and cultures present at the time. How much do you feel that there was an influence on the early Christian writers based on the Greek philosophy or the works of Plato? I mean, I've heard people argue that mm-hmm. the Christian concept of heaven and hell is really more of a platonic yeah. discussion. You know, how much do you feel that there was an influence upon the writers at that time?
Well, I can only answer that in a very general way to say I think that there was considerable influence. They were people of their time, and they were aware of these things that were around them, and they were influenced by other forms of thought, not just by one form of Judaism and its worldview, but that worldview that they inherited and that they worked with was affected by some of these other things. But that's a very broad statement for me to make. I agree that it was influenced by it. And they were engaged in it. They weren't isolating themselves off into a kind of monologue, but were allowing, I think, the influence of that whole cultural milieu to shape the way they spoke the message, the way they gave explanation to the message of what Jesus is for the world. So we begin with Constantine, I think, an era that we might call an era of triumphalism, where now Christianity, instead of being the persecuted little cult, is Lord and Master of the world, and the most powerful influence around, and uses its influence not so well. In that sort of world, you do not need to listen to the others, you do not need to try to understand them, you need only to tell them that they must turn around, accept the truth, or be in trouble. And that's the way it seems to have gone much of the time. But there were exceptions, because most certainly the gospel was always clearly at work in this context, and there were people who said other things from time to time. Nicholas of Cusa and some others who seemed to suggest it is impossible that so great a mystery as God could be approached by only one road. And some of these exceptional persons along the way tried to take a little bit more seriously, a little less judgmentally, the presence of other religions, and to try to understand how they might fit in actually to the plan of God, not simply as something that was antagonistic to God's plan. But I have to accept the fact that those are few and far between as the Christian empires of Western Europe, of Europe developed. Then we come, I jump real rapidly here in this little history, into the period of Christian missions, whether we think of the earliest periods of Christian missions, or I think especially of the ones that are just about in our own time, that is the 19th century. Big push of missionaries out of Europe and America into Africa and the Melanesian, Polynesian, Australia, and everywhere in the world we send missionaries with good intent. And there they went, along with the colonial powers, protected by the colonial powers, who came in there, Great Britain, France, Germany, all the others, Spain, Portugal, came in there to help these native people, these uncivilized, these savage people, to help them to come into what Christianity had, which for them oftentimes meant to come into a Western cultural practice and to reject everything about the faith and custom of their tradition and accept the faith of Christianity. Be baptized, get a Christian name, which meant a European name, or a biblical name, I guess, and so forth. So Christian missions went in hand in glove much of the time with the colonial presence. And people were converted in great multitudes, really. For what reasons, I guess we can't really judge entirely. To what extent it was really the freeing power of the gospel and the Holy Spirit working through that. To what extent it was that. To what extent it was simply being impressed. Look, these people come in with riches and power. They have sticks that shoot bullets. And they have motors. And they have, you know, the technology, the wealth, and the medicine and all the things they brought in just looked like nothing but absolute magic from another world. Now, to be that impressed, they must have something going for them, so we'll just do whatever they say. So there was a certain amount of that. And then we'll get those advantages too. They have books, they have marks on paper. And that seems to be powerful magic. So we'll learn all that. We'll take all that over. And we will have then the benefits that we see that they have. I'm saying that much of what was called the conversion was a response to this presence of power and a desire to share in whatever advantages that might have. And so people in missionary schools oftentimes learned, whether it was the intent or not, learned to hate themselves as a culture, at least. They learned not to appreciate what their forefathers had and handed back to them. In about the second generation, in many parts of Africa, revolutions, the protest began to develop. And some of the statements out of Kenya and other parts of Africa, I suppose, you have stolen our soul. So I guess what I'm going to say simply is that that whole thrust to do missionary work intended as an act of faith and sharing, labeled as witnessing to Christ throughout the world, and it certainly was all of that partly, it was received, if you take kind of the long view, with an ambivalence. There were some really positive things and appreciated things about it, and there were some very hated things about it, and it was hard to sort that out over a few generations, and probably that shouldn't be surprising. There were certainly movements of hostility against the Christian missions, but not always totally against Christianity or the Christian faith as such. And so what you have is simply a revolution against foreign-controlled missionary operations, and you have a kind of prophet arising out of a congregation in Africa, for instance, and leading people into a very special kind of understanding of what that Christian message is, what that biblical message is. And it turns out to be a kind of putting together of an African way of reading Old and New Testament, putting it together with many of the things of their own tradition, their own communion with ancestors and things of that sort, which I suppose ends up being what some people have called syncretism. Putting together of these two different kinds of things. Well, in the history of the encounter then, you have the period of struggle and persecution, then you have the period of triumphalism, which in some sense has been there to this time. But how shall we view this matter of the encounter? If we need models for thinking about it, I will offer a few here. One of the ways in which Christian people still today discuss this in church and theological meetings is in what I would call here the monologue. The general approach to people of any other religion is that they need to hear the words that we have to say to them, for we have the true message. They need to hear that. Within that, there is no necessity for listening to them. Unless you would like to listen to them to see how best to make your point after they get through, which is to listen to them only as a strategy. Not as though there were anything worthy of appreciation and respect in what they have to say religiously in their witness, but only as a strategy. The monologue approach suggests that somehow or another we are in possession of the truth and all the rest is falsehood, and they ought to be brought into the truth and to be shown how to reject all the rest. No matter how nice one tries to be with that approach, if that is the understanding, it ends up feeling to the other side very condescending. If you say, well, everything you had to say was okay, but now that you hear the word of Christ, that fulfills all the rest of what you have. That makes you feel, if you're on the other side of that, like you just got took. You just got dragged into something else. It was a roundabout way of condemning all that you are and all that you had before. The monologue. Most people that I talk to claim that that's about all that they have heard within the churches, is the condemnation of anyone and everyone with compassion, with sympathy for the fact that they are, if they are without an explicit knowledge of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, they go to hell by the millions. And I was raised on that understanding, and I think that the church has been fairly pervaded by that understanding of it. Remember,
we're getting away from it now.
There's less of that kind of talk today. But remember that the total Christian population in the world would be something less than 25% today. And that's stretching the point as to what the word Christian means quite a bit. The polylogue might be another model, and that is a kind of eclectic approach where one picks and chooses what you like from all the different religions, as though that were really a possibility. I have a great deal of difficulty with that because I feel very much that religions are deeply embedded in cultures, and that we always have deeper roots than that, and we cannot just sort of sit around and pick and choose as though we were on the mountaintop reaching down into the smorgasbord to get what we like. I think religion is a more coherent and complete kind of thing than that. So I don't think that's a very important model to be looking at. A third model that I want to talk about a little bit is one that calls for dialogue. Well, I guess maybe what I would think of here is people who, in exploring this religious thing and that religious thing and this one and that one, are quite indiscriminate about being attracted to certain things in this one, certain things in that one, and try for themselves to put together something that works for them, which makes it really and truly a kind of personal thing that, and I think religion always is a communal thing. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that I don't mean to condemn the process of doing something like that in particular, but it isn't going to be very helpful in the long run for Christians to think about that as the ideal model. As you can understand, I'm kind of challenging that model. I don't really think that's very fruitful for the Christian posture over against the rest of the religions of the world. So let me see if I can share what I think is involved in this third possibility, which I call a dialogue. Dialogue is based upon real listening and real sharing from the depths of your own convictions. For a Christian, that means sharing how it is that you understand God, how it is that you entrust yourself to God because of knowing Him through Jesus, His cross, and His resurrection. To be able to share that is important. To be able to listen to the other person, not as a strategy, as though you were going to enter the debate to show them what's weak about that position and to try to convince them against that position, but to try to understand what is religiously important, meaningful about that. That's listening, to really receive what the other person has and to try to appreciate the other person and, in a sense, to appreciate what it is that they're sharing with you and the profound beauty of it or meaningfulness of it or something like this. And that is not the same as saying, I now accept that as my own. That's not the same as that. But really listening. Now, if one, well, let me just watch out what I do here since I put this up here. I might as well kind of watch it a little. The attitudes that are at work in that, first of all, commitment. Dialogue cannot be carried out by people who are uncommitted because it presupposes that people have deep roots and deep convictions, and out of those convictions they come together in respect to give and to receive. So I'm not talking about wishy-washiness. I'm not talking about the search in which we go around and just sort of idly speculate about things together and philosophize together. I'm talking about deep partners who begin with respect for each other, hopefully having learned that out of their own spiritual traditions, how to respect each and every other person, and having deep respect for their own tradition, not apologizing for it at all. Now comes that ABC, that little C down there. Open to learn and to be changed by, to be enriched by, to be affected by. That, I think, is the key. Can a Christian engage in dialogue in such a way as to be vulnerable to altering in some way his or her way of understanding the whole business? And you'd be affected by it. And I think that we can bear that risk very nicely in the freedom and power of the gospel. Because dialogue, genuine dialogue, is in fact to make yourself vulnerable to some kind of influence coming to you through that other, whatever it may be. I wouldn't expect that honest people with commitments in their own traditions and exploring them would find themselves flipping over, but to have their way of understanding their own tradition altered, modified, enriched, broadened, or something like that by having come to know what the other person believes and the richness of that tradition. That, I think, is what is involved in dialogue. The effort, little D there hangs on there and doesn't make too much logical sense in that context, but it's that old thing I was talking about before, trying to get inside the other, to see it with the native eye. The effort to do that is part of dialogue. In this process, too, I suggest that in dialogue we get to know the other, and by getting to know the other, lo and behold, we get to know ourselves. Get to know ourselves better. Max Müller, a very important to me historian of religions, once said, I'll have to paraphrase it, either that or I'll have to stare at my notes long enough to find it. I will just paraphrase it. One who knows only one religion, a person who knows only one religion understands none. Possibly when one would start by saying that must be a little bit of an overstatement. But there is a truth about it, that one really begins to get a different perspective of what Christianity is. Its profundity, its depth, its richness. One gets a larger understanding of that by a sympathetic and appreciative understanding of other religions, I would say. And the more one understands out there, the more one sees the fullness and richness of one's own tradition. I like to make a comparison of that with the personal relationships that we have one by one in our families and in the village and wherever we are. I only learn to know about myself by knowing other people. It's the only way I can know that. And I'm, to this day, I am just absolutely amazed at the way my wife responds to a certain situation. Because I don't respond to that way. And as I try to get myself in her place to see it through her eyes, and if I ever succeed at that, I have now identified some ways in which I am me. I've learned to know more about myself by learning to understand others. And I think in all of our socializing process and all of our growing up, we just do that. We learn to know ourselves better as we learn to know others, with that imagination that gets inside as much as possible to understand, to see it from their angle. So religiously, we understand our own tradition even more deeply, I feel like I do, by understanding others. One of the ways in which this seems to work for many of my students, and it does for me too, is that when we meet something in another tradition and all of a sudden it begins to dawn on us how profound that is, how true that is, how beautiful and meaningful and important that is. And then it reminds you of something similar within the Christian tradition that you haven't paid a lot of attention to. But now you begin to pay attention in a new way to some dimension of your own tradition. It bounces you back. After you come to an appreciative understanding there, bounces you back into a renewed and enriched understanding of your own tradition. But of course the dialogue assumes that that might be the response on the other side too, that what you have to share might help that person to be enriched in that tradition, not necessarily to prescribe that the goal is that person give up that faith and come and be baptized. If that's the goal, it's not dialogue anymore. It's a strategy for something else. Mm-hmm.
I'm having to leave on that bus. I'm certainly willing to grant your position is good for you. I have some real deep appreciations for the theology of the Native Americans. But I would like to know, how do you handle Christ's statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me, and go and make disciples? How does that fit in?
Oh, well, I'm not going to be able to give you a glib answer before the bus leaves. I know that, because I have to live with that. I know those passages, of course, very well. I think we're going to have to not just look at those passages, but look at the overall understanding of God's mercy and love that comes to us through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Then I guess I would go to the context of each of those statements and to try to see what was at stake there. What was the point that was to be made in that context? And only then would I begin to ask the question of whether taking that statement out of that context and making it a rubric over this whole new discovery that we have of these many religions on this ever smaller globe of ours, to ask whether that passage simply settles that issue or whether it's more complex. I guess that's the way I'd go at the question.
Briefly, you were saying that the statement, no one comes to the Father but by me, would be then altered, amended to say, but there may be other ways.
Yeah, and I would find warrant in the scriptures for other possible ways. And there have been attempts to show how St. John's talk about the Word was made flesh. The Word was in the beginning. The Word as a kind of universal manifestation, revelation, revealing activity of the one God, which has been from all time and is to all time, and now that Word became flesh. Now, some have taken that to say, and that leaves it kind of wide open, how else in all the world might that Logos of the one God be manifesting itself? Questions, but not answers on that.
You don't take that to mean that the Word became flesh in the person of Christ.
Oh, yes. And so the viewpoint
of
that might be the issue right there. That is the issue right there. Whether or not God has only dealt mercifully with the world in Jesus Christ or whether he might, outside of that whole Judaic Christian tradition, be dealing mercifully with the world in ways that we cannot necessarily reconcile with this. And the question is whether to leave that an open issue or not. That's kind of where I want to go on this point, because what I want to say, I wish, make sure you don't miss your bus, but what I want to say about this, I guess, is that I don't think that it is required of us to settle that issue in order to be witnesses and in order to be faithful witnesses to the gospel of Jesus Christ. I would suggest that the call to be witnesses, and I know that's just one word, that's just one of the models. Another model is to make disciples. But the call to be witnesses is not the call to be prosecutors, and it is not the call to be the judge. It is the call to share the depth and richness of the love of God as we have come to know it in Jesus the Christ. And I have never thought that the only motive for doing that was the image of 75% of the world's population innocently going down into the depths of hell because we didn't get the word to them. I've never felt that it was quite, I've never quite been able to accept that image of things. Because some would say that if you don't make the state the exclusive statement that outside of this, we know that there cannot possibly be any other way that the love of God would embrace people. If we know that, and only because of that, we must go out and share it. I think we'd better close down Holden Village and get going, you know, and really panic about the whole thing. Because, so I guess what I'm saying is, the question of how God's love will, or how it is discriminating, peace, how it is discriminating, and how it will embrace eternally in Christianity alone, in other religions as well, and by what criteria? I don't know. How in the world can a human being pretend to judge that? Even with a Bible passage, as far as I'm concerned, a Bible passage doesn't settle the issue, because the whole message and the whole love of God is just pointed to in all those Bible passages, each in its own kind of context, more or less. And it's that whole sweep of things that I think we have to look at. Now, I'm going to defend myself before it's over yet of one thing. I'll tell you what I think universalism is, because that's always the nasty charge in my church, at least. If you don't make the exclusive statement and make it clean and clear and consistent, then sometimes you are called a universalist. But I think what a universalist position is a dogmatic position. It's the statement that it doesn't matter which path you take, all in the end will be saved. And as far as I'm concerned, that is mounting the throne of the judge in the same way that the exclusivist mounts the throne of the judge. Each of them taking an opposite point of view, but assuming that they can say in a kind of absolute way one of those things. And I'm suggesting that maybe the call to be a Christian and the call to be a disciple of Jesus is a call simply to be a servant of that love that he was a servant of and that he shared with us. And that it is not a call to settle that issue ourselves and to make pronouncements about that issue, but rather to live out the witness as much as we can, to affirm and embrace and include as much as we can, because we know the expansiveness of the loving heart of God, but without making either the universalist or the exclusivist kind of judgment. Well, that's kind of where I hang things, and that may sound like a cop-out to folks, but that's where I am.
I don't know if you know Carl Sagerham, do you?
No.
Well, he was a bishop in the southwestern United States for 25 years, and he's 80 years old, and he he would agree with you wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm. I think that I've begun to meet quite a few people who would, and I find that if I talk to people within some of the more conservative branches of Christianity, including Lutheranism, I find that the people who would be in agreement with me tend to be in an older age bracket for reasons which I guess we all can speculate about, but I think there's a kind of generosity and mellowing out that seems to happen out of the long experience of the love of God.
I always thought of him as one of the wisest theologians I've ever known. And we live in the same complex, so we together a lot, and we've had a chance to converse a great deal on this point. And I just think he's right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Over 20 years ago, when I was in seminary, I remember a particular professor, who's now the president of the Missouri Synod, saying the very thing you said in conclusion, believe it or not, because that's where I learned it, saying that our job is not to condemn or condone eternally, but to let it kind of hang in there and bear our witness and let God decide about all those unanswered kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. I remember him saying that.
Mm-hmm.
The question for me ever since then, and I don't remember what I even asked at that time, was given that and accepting that, it seems to me there is still a role, a pastoral role, a whole church role in terms of what the prophets and the apostles have done all through the scriptures that say, short of making a judgment about eternity, this is wrong, this is right, this is acceptable, this isn't. That, to me, it seems to be the big challenge when you're dealing with people, whether they're Muslims or whether they're other Christians or nothing, to be able to say, this is the word of God, but this is contrary.
It's a philosophical thing, but I've always contemplated, why would God, if we take Jesus Christ as the Son of God, God's Son, the Word as flesh, why would God send His very Son to not to the whole world and only to one portion of people? Why would He not want acceptance of His Son rather than rejection of His Son through millions and millions of people in the world? Why would we say that Christ is okay for this people, but this people doesn't necessarily need to believe in Christ, while Christ is the very Son of God and the very Word of God? And why would God send such a treasure to one part of the world and say, well, this doesn't really matter to this part of the world?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that really struck me one day.
Anybody wish to respond to that?
I think a lot of it, what you were saying earlier, talks about just the culture and how people are raised. And I think that God reaches people in different ways. And in our culture, what's meaningful to many of us is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. In other cultures, it's a different way. That doesn't have the meaning to them, but it would in other cultures. And I think to realize that and not to, like you were saying, I really appreciate that, in imposing our Christianity on other people, we're also imposing our culture. And then we're denying them their culture.
I disagree, though. Christ came to fulfill every culture. Christ did not come to tear down cultures. That's our mistake as we go in and be missionaries.
That's true.
But I would maintain that Christ is the fulfillment of every culture. As God created cultures, I believe that He sent Christ to complete a culture.
I think that the Christians would have to affirm that Jesus is God's own gift of Himself to the world, to the whole world. Now, I think, so that at least tries to affirm what you're saying. And I don't think any Christian could have a problem with that. Just kind of where you go from there in setting up the lines. Now, if people in an East Asian Buddhist culture just cannot make any sense out of this old Jewish idea of a Messiah and all the things that get trapped into that and that, and they've heard the message, but not in a way that they can plug into, for reasons I think that are tied up in all the cultural, linguistic, and everything, all those things. The question is, can that be left an open statement, an open question? Is it possible that the divine Logos, the very one who is called then the Son of God in this context, that he enters into other cultural contexts, other ways, and by other names is known, by other ways is recognized and responded to? Could we leave it open for the possibility of that while we go ahead and bear our servant witness? The other witness that gets born so often is not so much a servant witness as a master witness. I'll caricature just a little. Say, folks, we have the answers. We have the truth. We want to show you now what it's like to really be, to really know God. And rather than coming in that way as the ones who know it all, and thus to come in and serve, to serve them on their own, and take that model at least and let that become the base out of which the witness happens. And let God do with the witness what he will.
You said before that you feel that you are a universalist. A universalist would say that all people
paths
know.
Are pure sincere.
Would you feel more comfortable with the idea of there are certain segments within each experience, each cultural experience of religion, which people who are more or less holy in their own way, that would be... Would a universalist say that all people will achieve salvation? Would that be that?
I think so.
Well, then
I don't really know who decides what the right definition of a universalist is.
Is there a train of thought which says that you know, there are some people, Christians, who do not live by the Christian... Well, who really... the whole question of heaven and hell. Do other cultures, other world religions, have that sort of a sense of I know it's salt you can't give
either orness?
Yeah, I mean, and if they do, is that something which, like you would say, for example, if I have a good friend who's Jewish,
mm-hmm.
it's not so much important for me to convert him to Christianity as it is for him to live out the Jewish faith in a righteous and meaningful way. Is that what you would feel?
Yeah, I think that with my Jewish friends, I like to talk to them about not only my tradition, but I like to talk to them about theirs. And I would like to talk to them about the God of mercy, about the meaning of grace in the context of the Hebrew Scriptures, as well as in the context of my understanding of Jesus the Christ. I'm not sure where to plug in to your comment, except to say, and maybe that was what you were getting at too, there, I do not mean that we are uncritical of anything, of just everything. We better not be uncritical of the idolatry in ourselves and in each other within the Christian
context.
Well,
how about the Muslim treatment of women? Is that something that is...
Well, to the extent that it's not right, one would I think, take a stand against that. Right? See, I'm not suggesting an affirmation of everything that a religion does and stands for, but the only thing I would be doing is saying I would not a priori want to assume that within that religious context, a person who is faithful to that religious context cannot live eternally in the love of God. I would not want to make that judgment. But certainly I would not want to affirm everything that Muslims have had to say. Dale.
For me, the purposes of God are expressed in our creed, God the Creator, God the Redeemer, and God the Sanctifier. And to the extent to which religions help people discover those realities, I would affirm them. For myself, I believe I have found the fullest expression of that in Christ. And that, but I think Christ as the cosmic Christ may be revealed in other religions, so that I still feel comfortable in saying that as a Christian, it's not for me to kind of go shopping and one is as good as another and this kind of thing, but certainly to value those elements in other religions that seem to serve God's purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And also at the same time to recognize then it is possible to turn my Christianity into an idolatry to serve my own ends also. And so that I never assume that I have the answer and can clobber people with it.
Yeah, right. Okay.
One of the problems that I have,
I've been missing you, I'm sorry.
I think in terms of ultimate ends, salvation and the hereafter type of thing, when you look at other religions compared with Christianity or with each other, they seem to be so contradictory in terms of some things that it's hard for me to understand how they are all inclusive of God's action, will, acceptance, and whatever. And I think that's the problem that that we're really up against. If you say God is working through this, that, and the other thing, and yet they contradict each other, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Not initially, but it seems to me that as the deeper one gets into understanding the others, the more likely one is to find the points of resonance. The points at which I see here, at least, I see kind of what this is getting at, and it rings bells with me. The rest of this, I still don't get. You know?
What about something as basic as, if I'm accurately portraying it, the Christian belief that it is by grace, many other religions seeing man's working himself up to a certain point of perfection, or whatever. Are those kind of
I think that would be my primary focus, the primary focus of my witness to others, because there is, as in Christianity, maybe even more so in some of the other religions, that attitude of what you point to as a kind of work righteousness. But the other side of it is that I see also within those traditions beautiful expressions of surrender to the grace that upholds us. For instance, in the most self-powered kind of religion you can think of, like Zen Buddhism, which is just practice, 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 do it yourself, do it yourself, do it yourself. Why is it that a Zen priest, in his final expression of the story of the Zen monk, says, and he, when he had experienced Satori, enlightenment, awakening, and he pictures it in a great big hand sits this little monk, in hilarity, just being upheld, as though when you strive and strive and strive and strive and strive and push, all that does is forces you to let go. And when you let go, suddenly you realize that grace upholds you. Almost as though it's that. But there are explicitly in some forms of Buddhism and some forms of Hinduism, in those religions, which seem so different from ours, there are two expressions I could point at quickly where it is attributed to the power of the loving God alone that we might come to liberation. So it's not consistency. The pointing at idolatry is pointing at anything that we trust other than the merciful hand of God himself. And if we trust our having it straight in our head, and that puts us in a better position than the people who don't have it straight in their head, that has become our idol. For it is not having it straight in our head, it is entrusting ourselves to his grace. And so wherever we would find the idol, I think we would have a right to point at it, but not focusing our primary attention out there in the others, but maybe in our closest circles, as much at least. I want to make sure you get a chance to share what you had to say with this group, because I realize I've bypassed your hand.
A couple comments. I think it's very helpful to observe what you observe. Maybe another way to say it is that God will do what God will do, regardless of what we
think about
say.
Whether we approve or not.
Whether we approve or not. And that, and that's probably helpful in the mission effort in the long run, because I do think mission has been badly used over the centuries. I suppose partly because of coming in with armies and one thing or another. Nonetheless, true though, like you were saying, Christ. The message of Christ is what has been revealed to us, so we still are compelled to go out and speak. Obviously, it wasn't meant just for Jewish people, because if it were, then it would have been in a form that Jewish people would have wholeheartedly embraced, it seems to me.
Well, this is to stir the waters and to keep us thinking about these things, and I must not prevent people who need to move on to other things from doing it. I was told as a teaching staff I must end my sessions at least as promptly as I begin them. And so thank you very much for puzzling with me about this matter, and I'm happy to talk about it in the days ahead, over coffee or anyway. Thank you.